www.cbc.org/craftsfair/winter for more information.
Coming up tonight after the news, KPFA's local station board candidate forum will be on from 7 to 8 p.m. here on KPFA. So tune in. And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, back in Washington, D.C., weaving California and Washington, D.C. in perpetuity, perhaps. So, yes, and I was just at a meeting on Capitol Hill of faith and politics, and it was like, oh, interfaith dialogue, and my inner coyote did want to chew its arm off, going, because the facilitators were like, because I was like, guiding story, we want a guiding story, and they're like, yes, but let's get back to what separates us and what's not working. I'm like, oh, but there was a wonderful human ally in the room, you know, and it's just to remind all of us that, you know, somebody said we're never more than 10 feet from a spider. I love that idea. We're never more than 10 feet from an ally. And so there are so many wonderful people that, you know, we all and I've known peripherally, and now it seems like it's a kind of deeper level of cahooting. So overhead right now in Berkeley is the moon and Saturn conjoined in Sagittarius, the power of the woman storyteller, the unifying story. It is very Scheherazadean. And we remember also part of our frame story, the beautiful, heartening, guiding astro-mytho story, is that, you know, Uranus trickster redeemer within all of us, spirit of ingenuity, spirit of nature's resilience, spirit of against all odds we can do this, you know, coyote and raven, and, you know, the seeds that sprout after cataclysm. So Uranus is retrograde, inward, and then stations right on Christmas Day. Christmas could be really real this year, and goes forward out into the world. It is the emergence of the Venusian storytelling trickster redeemer within all of our hearts, regardless of temporary age, race, and gender assignment. So there's that dynamic. So more than perfectly, our topic today is Scheherazade, the power of the woman storyteller, the Paris climate talks upcoming. Beautiful timing. We'll get into on that, because it ends right on a new moon in Sagittarius, power of story being birthed from this gathering. So Scheherazade, Paris climate talks, global treaty, guiding, unifying story. More than perfectly, we are welcoming longtime ally Osprey Oriel Lake, author of Uprising for the Earth, Reconnecting Culture with the Earth. She's on her way to the Paris talks, which are November 30th to December 11th, which is a new moon. Osprey Oriel Lake is the founder, director of We Can, Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, and the co-chair of the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature. Welcome. Welcome, Oriel.
Oh, it's so good to be with you today. Hi.
That's wonderful. Well, yes, it is such a great time of convening, and you are off to Paris, and so we will be telepathically, you know, with you. The timing is really intriguing, again. You know, November 30th through December 11th, which is a new moon in Sagittarius. It's the birth of a new story. So, well done.
I think Mother Earth had everything to do with that, but I'm really honored to be participating and doing everything that I can.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So our telepathic, the beauty of radio and so much we can do in our convening and the wonderful dynamic audience. Hello, everybody. So, you know, what would you like, what quality of blessing would you like from everyone to whom you're speaking to take with you to Paris?
Thank you for asking that question. I mean, I think that, you know, going into the United Nations climate talks at the end of the year, you know, of course, it's not the end-all game for sure. There's going to be Paris and beyond. But Paris does matter. It is an epic moment. It is a historical moment because, you know, people have been focusing on these climate negotiations for years. This is, you know, COP21, the Conference of Parties, number 21. And we're at these big ecological tipping points, as we know. So at one level, we really do need to get the global community, all of our Earth community, really focused on having the best outcome that we can get. And that, you know, there can always be an 11th hour save. And maybe this is one of those moments we can all congeal to make that happen and conjure that to happen, because right now, you know, the commitments from governments in terms of carbon emission reductions are not enough. We know that, you know, scientists are telling us 80% of fossil fuel reserves must be left in the ground. That's not on the table in the Paris talks. The fact that, you know, we need to keep global temperatures well below 1.5 degrees. That's not on the table in the climate Paris talk. So, you know, we know there's, you know, challenges. You know, this is a big, you know, David and Goliath situation. And so we need everyone really focusing on, you know, opening people's hearts and minds and spirits to the fact that, you know, some really good decisions could come out of being in Paris. And we want to see a lot of folks on the streets. We know the people's movements for climate justice are going to be marching, you know, en masse before the COP begins. They will be marching afterwards, and there'll be decentralized actions happening all over the world that people can participate in and find about online through looking at the people's movements. Look for that online and find out where you can be participating and tweeting and Skyping and Facebooking and really engaging, because the more we can let world governments know that, you know, we want there to be, you know, a stop and change around global warming, the more that they can act in our favor. So that's what I'm really hoping people focus on, that we can make a difference, that we can really see our way through this very narrow, delicate time in the human story.
And it is, again, gathering everybody's stories, and even just on NPR, driving over here, important story on the Kuna Indians, beloved and intimate to many of us because of our great ally Natalia Kuna Prince, who makes the most wonderful shoes from Ornette Mole. She takes to the Kuna Indians off the coast of Panama, but they might be one of the first peoples to relocate. Their islands are the rising waters, and they admit their complicity because they were. You know, doing many, I mean, small things that they now view as disastrous, going, ooh. But so everywhere, I mean, everywhere is this rising up of the crisis. And I love in the blurbs to your book, you know, Uprising for the Earth, you know, Joanna Macy had a wonderful blurb talking about how you animate the peril and the promise, but you also animate the winds off the mountain that can replenish us. So, you know, that is important that we be replenished by what we love, yeah?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, we're living in a remarkable time in which we have the opportunity really to change at the deepest level everything about how we are living, who we are, and our values. And this urgency of global warming, which is really the result of how we've been living a very long time. It's not the only, you know, problem, if you will. It's just demonstrating and reflecting back to us how we've been living. It's also the opportunity maybe it's forcing us rather to redesign, you know, our economic systems, our legal systems regarding nature, you know, our daily consumption habits, our understanding of living in harmony with Mother Earth and with each other. And so I think it's sort of like a moment that we can, in essence, look at the very DNA of our systems, because that's what we're really looking at is systemic change. And how do we really bring in the fact of the socioeconomic problems? You know, we need to deal with Black Lives Matter as much as we need to be dealing with the fact of, you know, ocean pollution, as much as we need to be dealing with frontline communities. As you were just mentioning one, you know, in terms of people are going to be impacted first and worst. You know, of course, our organization is very focused on women and how climate change is affecting women and what their solutions are as well. And in this moment, you know, how do we look at this moment of peril and turn this into the moment we've all been working on for years and years and years, which is, you know, taking down these old dominator worldviews, this monopolized economy, capitalism, the way we're looking at colonialism, patriarchy, and saying, you know, we all know we need this change so we can lift up women's rights, indigenous rights, rights of nature, and living in a very different way than we have been. This is sort of our moment to build momentum for that.
And that we all become increasingly effective storytellers, that, you know, exactly as the permaculture solutions, again, as Penny Livingston, next week's guest, yes, and Starhawk also there, permaculture solutions for climate change, you know, that it is no isolated crisis. It's a crisis of isolation. It's all interwoven. I love that so many guests on the show and just good people in the world, but I love David Bloom, again, kind of ingenious. We can make alcohol fuel out of almost all garbage and trash. It's a whole long, wonderful series of shows. But he says, you know, when you provide women with fuel right in the village, they don't have to cut down the trees and they don't have to expose themselves to, you know, attack and rape. I mean, it's all connected. I mean, the fuel we run on and the equality of men and women and humans and the rest of critters on this earth, it's all connected. So the other wonderful blurb on your book page is you know, Rachel Carson's quote, the gist of which is, when, you know, as we focus our attention on wonder, we have less taste for destruction. Ah, that's really good. Yeah, because the art of directing collective attention is part of your dedication, yeah?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons that I really focused on the book is I wanted to deeply go into a narrative around how it is, you know, at one level, to really go through the transformation we need. It is about reconnecting with nature. It is about remembering that we are part and particle of Mother Earth, and how, you know, it's very challenging in our modern society with over half of the world's population living in urban environments to remember the trees and the forests and the land. And you know, I talk to so many women in the work that I do, and just really reminding women that the reason that we have a monthly cycle is because we're connected to the moon, and why is it happening once a month? And just these profound ways that we are part and particle of Mother Earth's body, and remembering that, because it's very hard to care for something that we're disconnected to. I mean, we care for the things that we love. And how do we really fall in love again with Mother Earth, and how do we build those reconnections, I think, is underneath, you know, this crisis that we're facing at so many levels, both economically, environmentally, these issues around misogynistic ideas, patriarchy, racism. I think underneath it all, we have to keep remembering that it's very difficult to heal if we are disconnected. And that connection is so central to, you know, this new time and the new story.
Well, everything that increases intimacy, again, you know, Venus within us all represents, you know, the stepping into intimacy with everything, including the wind and the what did come out of the Capitol Hill interfaith meeting, one interesting Zoroastrian woman, but she did say, you know, when she works in Israel, between Arabs and Israelis, that it was the secular, and I go, oh, I really want to compost the word secular because it's such a booby prize, but it was the secular people who really got on well, going, no problem, whose level of tolerance was increased, going, right, I never go to the mosque, I never go to the temple, and I like everybody. So it's, and then I just, as a little side note from a number of conversations of people working in the Middle East, going, you know, the word secular is really a booby prize, because it carries the connotation of not holy. You know, do you want a fundamentalist country or a not holy secular? So I like, as you know, word crafting. What about we called it inclusive? An inclusive culture, an inclusive society, or a tolerant society, you know, because the secular thing really is a booby prize. So anyway, I just, as you know, I'm always in favor of composting old, tired language, because surprising language liberates everybody into a new story. If people have heard the language, there's likely a prison for it already. So fountains of new language. But I know that you were ardent also in our backstage conversing about, you know, honoring fire. Did you want to bring fire into play?
Sure, absolutely. And I just really want to echo your what you said about words. I mean, I think words are so potent and like incantations into what it is that we're calling forth. And I really love you talking about new words and how that opens our minds. And one thing that I've been looking at, and of course, you know, there's so many, at a very practical level, the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network is going to Paris to advocate inside the halls of COP21. We're an accredited organization, so we actually will be working with the Women and Gender Constituency, which is part of the UNFCCC, actually on the documents to really fight for gender equality, indigenous rights, rights of nature, and a lot of these things that we know are paramount to climate justice and efforts going forward. We will also be working to put on several very large events, Women Leading Solutions on the Frontlines of Climate Change, where we're bringing a lot of frontline and indigenous women to come and tell their frontline stories and make sure that they are able to tell their stories in front of policymakers, because we know their stories have huge impact in helping decisions go in the direction that we want them to go. So there's all this conjuring going on around, you know, what will actually happen on the ground and how we can negotiate for the best outcomes. But within that, you know, I have been really looking at a more, you know, in more sort of my internal journey at a meta level about our relationship with fire itself. And, you know, what is it about this power of consuming? And, you know, if we look at global warming and, you know, burning fossil fuels, what sort of relationship is this, and where have we sort of lost our origin story and our connection to our relationship with this element? So I want to read a few paragraphs from my book about a reflection on fire, which is: the essence and presence of fire is about transformation, a phenomenon that has captivated us since ancient times. Our multivalent, sacred, and yet somehow peculiar relationship with fire is universal. When we turn to the many fire origin stories and myths from cultures around the world, we find that often they impart a warning of sorts. Many of the old stories tell us outright that fire is not freely given. It must be stolen. In his book, Myths of the Origin of Fire, social anthropologist James Frazier relates how fire bringers are often legendary cultural figures, animal or human, that steal the original flame and then offer it to the people. There are numerous American Indian stories in which coyote cleverly snatches the fire, but the thief can also be a turtle, a raven, frog, or fox, who slyly makes off with the flame. And then I go on to tell a lot of those stories, but I'm just going to conclude with this one other part. Then there is the well-known Western myth of Prometheus, the Greek hero who steals fire from the gods for human use and creativity. Zeus had decided to withhold fire from humankind, but Prometheus, in his fondness for humans, stole it and delivered it to the mortal kind hidden inside a fennel stick. So there's many interpretations about this, but the stolen fire story suggests that our ancestors long ago wished for us to be mindful and respectful of this sacred element. That the flame is not freely given can warn us that the technology of fire is a double-edged sword. The fire allows us many comforts while also giving us the power to harm ourselves and others and the natural world in which we live. The old stories indicate an unusual relationship. The fire has to be stolen because the guardians of the flame are not sure that humans should have it or can control it. On the other hand, if we are to have it, we need to understand that fire is a hard-won prize, and we need to make an adequate exchange for its use. Otherwise, it is a theft. Apparently, we have not yet made the proper offering in return nor learned how to use it responsibly. So it is that we are in a time now to really remedy immediately our relationship with fire.
Yes, the overheating. And again, in the Trickster Training Council I convene on Monday nights, which is very adorable, again, without hubris, without presumption of causation, one of our wonderful teammates who presides over very dry land in Texas, while she was talking to us, her house was surrounded by fire. And so we, again, without presumption, without hubris, without whatever, you know, we go, well, you know, again, directing traffic, going, no, not there, fire, over here. So we did, and I've talked to firemen about this. Everybody's got a spiritual underneath their witness relocation program kind of conditioning front, because the fire response responders, and they were happy to be kind of renamed fire responders rather than firefighters, talked about the intelligence and quality of each fire. And they go, we don't normally talk about this to people because they wouldn't understand. But everything, you know, our animism be released. But so we did, everyone lit a little candle to go, we love you, fire, here. It's like create ritual or have arson. Take your pick. And as we were talking, the fires around our friend's house went out. We go, all right, mm-hmm. we don't know, but it's the trickster experiment. It's, we're going, not there, but here. It's like the Findhorn gardening, you know, no weeds, not here, but over here. And I do love, you know, since we got stuck with the name ISIS, you know, for Daesh, really, it's only the Western media that calls Daesh ISIS, the Egyptian goddess of nature. But since we were stuck with that, there is a really important, I think, useful for all of us in Paris about collaborating with everybody. The story that comes out of ISIS and Osiris, which is the horses of the chariot of the sun have broken free, and fire is about to be cataclysmically unleashed on the earth, and the gods and goddesses go to everybody going, can you help? Can you help? And nobody can help, except the only person they haven't asked is Set, who's the bad guy, who's always chopping up Osiris and tossing his members into the ocean and just being terrible. And so they have no choice. They go to him, and they go, oh, Set, oh, incarnation of, you know, diabolical badness, you know, can you help us? And he goes, yeah, sure thing. Okay. And he does. He saves the earth from over fire, you know, and I think that's, you know, we're willing, there's an ally 10 feet away, even if they don't look like it, you know, it might be Set, you know, I think it's the quality that in underneath all of that in the mythology, there is a trippy, ironic guidance from the Middle East about sometimes you got to cooperate with the devil to save the world, you know, and I think that I just wanted to put that up there about, you know, sometimes to deal with fire, to deal with overheating, climate change, you're willing to, you know, whoever can help, everybody welcome.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because one of the things that it reminded me to speak about too is one of the things that the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network in allyship with the Global Alliance for Rights of Nature is hosting in during the climate talks in Paris. We're going to be having a 2-day International Rights of Nature Tribunal. You know, and at one level, it is about, you know, renewing our relationship with nature and our laws around nature and how we can move into a new relationship with our legal systems to honor the earth. And right now around the world, in almost all non-indigenous systems of law, as we know, nature and ecosystems are treated only as property. So, you know, our rivers, our forests, our mountains are treated as property. And rights of nature, in essence, is very different in that it furthers these, it really changes how we look at these property-based environmental laws and changes them. And pretty much says that we need to see nature as a rights-bearing entity. So at the heart of it, it sees a profound legal and cultural paradigm shift in understanding, you know, how we relate to the natural world. So we're going to be having these tribunals in which people are going to be able to come forward and tell cases around GMOs, cases around climate change and false solutions to climate change like geoengineering and different market mechanisms and carbon offsets, and to talk about defenders of the land and how they're being persecuted, and be able to come forward with cases of fracking and many others to say, you know, these are violations against the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Mother Earth. These are violations against the rights of nature. And how can we create these new legal frameworks that allow us to really see nature thriving and surviving and protect nature under new legal laws? And, you know, we're seeing that actually this is not just some fancy concept. The fact is in 2008, Ecuador became the first country in the world to recognize rights of nature in their constitution. And since then, Bolivia has about 11 rights of nature laws in their country. And before this, these national developments in the United States, starting with the rural U.S. community of Tamaqua Borough, Pennsylvania, they were able to establish ordinances in their local communities around recognizing rights of nature. And since then, there's been about 120 communities in the United States that passed local ordinances where rights of nature is recognized and people can protect their waterways. Just up in Mendocino County here, north of me in California last year, Mendocino County passed a rights of nature ordinance so that no fracking can happen in their community. So these are real laws that are being put in place. But I'm very excited in Paris because we're going to be really bringing, this is the third International Rights of Nature Tribunal, to this really large global stage so we can start offering other ways of viewing how we can deal with these ecological and social problems that we're facing in a way that really is in harmony with nature and seeing, you know, the natural laws of the earth being who we need to attune to ecologically, in terms of also our economic structures, and seeing that we're really a subset of Mother Earth, not the other way around, and actually showing people in an educational format through these tribunals how it could actually look. So I'm very excited about bringing this element to a space that, you know, traditionally is not looking at these types of concepts.
Yes. And I love, Carolyn Raffensperger is saying, you know, in regard to economic systems, you know, how do we measure wealth? And she says, what if we measured wealth in the number of eagle hatchlings, you know, in the number of, certainly talking about the rights of rivers to have their curves and, you know, from Penny Livingston and Carmen Gonzalez, you know, just the, let all natural facts be social strategy metaphors. When water runs in a straight line, you know, imprisoned, it cannot metabolize poison. When it's curvy, it can metabolize the poison. It can cleanse itself. And therefore, linguistically and actionally, you know, for us, we go, well, we want to be curvy. We want to be serpentine, the long exiled snake, the serpentine quality, the kind of snaky thing, the spiraling dynamic as part of our strategy. Because you mentioned Prometheus, that's right, and you know, we want to keep going further back to, you know, to the origin stories, to the originating impulse, because the story of Prometheus, right, that comes to us as he steals fire, and then he's punished, right, in this horrible way. He's chained to a rock, and an eagle plucks out his liver, and it grows back, and the eagle comes back, and but that's not the original thing, because Hercules frees him. So it's not a finger wagging, don't, you know, you're going to be a martyr if you do a good thing. And then Hercules can be Mars, volatile, hot-headed, as well as rescuer, like we all can be. But I love that the gods and goddesses in the ancient world, when Hercules was behaving badly, they sentenced him to go to the underworld to learn knitting and weaving. And I love that. You know, there's Bush and Cheney knitting tea cozies in the underworld. Because back to your great reanimating of the tribunal, right? The Rights of Nature Tribunal. And a tribunal, Doris Lessing did a great thing with this in one of her later space novels, in which everybody gets together and they put the white race on trial, right? But they don't sentence them to grumpiness. They just have the stories, and then they sentence them to, you know, compassion and probably knitting tea cozies in the underworld. But I like with a tribunal, you know, imaginative sentencing. I'm all for imaginative sentencing. And we sentence you to, you know, 10 years of aromatherapy and, 5 years of knitting in the underworld. And Trickster does like to leaven the thing. And GMOs, you know, we sentence you to, 3 months at Findhorn. I mean, whatever. I mean, so the tribunal, do you have sentencing in mind?
Yes, we do.
Oh,
and in fact, you know, we kind of work with restorative justice, which I'm just learning about. And I think it's really interesting because it's along the lines sort of what you were describing, which is, you know, what are the sentencings that actually produce the results that you want? And, not in the sense that we would think perhaps in our Western society about punishment, but more
healing.
It's reconciliation. It's, really what is the deeper reconciliation that we really want to see? And it reminds me of something that you and I talked about earlier around this one African tribe in which if someone in the community does something that is, you know, not appropriate or remiss, instead of punishing that person for the next 2 weeks, as I understand it, everyone in the community comes literally every waking hour, one by one, and stands with that person and tells a story about that person's life that they remember of how they helped the community, how they helped that person, and they relate back to the person, reminding them of who they are and their better nature. And they all take turns talking for week after week, telling the person the story to remind them who they are. And that's, quote unquote, the punishment for the wrongdoing.
I love that, and that because I cover popular culture for everybody. I did at the time say there was a really great Law and Order criminal intent where the bad people are the gist of it is that Bobby has done research on them, and he steps up to these people who are about to kill them and says, you sing in the choir and you love your mother and you did these good things and you went to theology. Is it come to this? And then person drops his gun, and you know again that stepping into intimacy. We're going to take a very short musical break right now with the Congo music you've sent. Our wonderful guest is Osprey Oriel Lake. We are honoring Scheherazade Women's Storytelling Within Us All, and also the upcoming Paris Climate Talks. And when we come back, we will talk about your projects in the Congo, yes?
Great, thank you.
Okay. And there we have it. Our guest, Osprey Oriel Lake, will animate the Congo music and the project she's doing. This is Caroline Casey. I'm your weaver of context for the Visionary Activist Show on KPFA, KPFK, and KFCF in Fresno and Santa Cruz, something. Osprey Oriel Lake. So yes, the Congo. You sent the music because you were doing projects in the Congo. How can we tell us that story?
Yeah, well, it's really exciting. What we do at WECAN, Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, is we, in addition to a lot of the advocacy work that we do, particularly, of course, focusing on women, really sharing many stories, articles, do advocacy work in many arenas around how women are the most negatively impacted by climate change and environmental degradation, but also how they are absolutely key to solutions. And many of the women we work with all over the world tell us, you know, we're not victims. We are the solution. And they're absolutely right. And, you know, just as an example, 60-80% of all household food production in developing countries is done by women. So when we have all these conversations about food security and food sovereignty, we're really talking about women. Again, around water programs, United Nations studies show us if you don't have women engaged in these programs, they simply don't work, because it's the women who are the most often the ones collecting the water, and they're the ones who have the local water knowledge. So, you know, I could go on and on about incredible statistics about why women are so essential right now when we're talking about solutions to climate change. And I would just suggest to people that they go to our website at wecaninternational.org, and you can see a whole section on why women, and it's just incredibly inspiring, and it tells their stories and why we're focusing so much right now on women's leadership. And, you know, what we'd like to say, it's not about putting men down, but it's definitely about lifting women up and working together. And we've not been hearing from women. And, you know, historically, their voices and actions have been silenced. And so as we bring women into the story, we see enormous healing and balancing to society for a host of reasons that is essential right now. So how this leads into the Congo is that for the last few years, we've been having trainings in the Middle East, North Africa region, in South America, in DR Congo, different regions of the world. And we have a partner organization, SAFECO, that is in Eastern Congo. And together, we really started focusing on how we could protect both the indigenous people of the Itombe region, which is in the Congo Basin, and the forests there. Because a big part, as I'm sure everyone knows, of really protecting our climate is about protecting our forests. And there's four major forests in the world, the Congo Basin being one of them. And, you know, there are just such alarming rates of deforestation. So we said, what could we do, again, with this sort of holistic, comprehensive way of viewing things, where we could support the indigenous women on the ground who are facing tremendous violence and discrimination in DR Congo, huge amounts of poverty. And save the forest and, you know, sort of have a program that addressed all of these things and protect the forest for all of us, for the climate and future generations to come. So we are working with these pygmy women, and we're doing a whole series of tree plantings where we have different tree nurseries planting thousands of trees to reforest damaged areas that have already been logged. It started then moving into other arenas where the local communities are now forming community groups where they go out to, you know, make sure that illegal timber harvesting is not happening in the regions. We're also now working with another group to bring in solar light so that people are not having to chop down trees to have only fuel wood for their cooking fires, but also light at night. So bringing in these handheld light devices, solar light devices, as well as clean cook stoves, and also all of this providing ways for women to earn money through the selling of the lights or through the trees, the tree planting. So it's addressing a lot of different issues all at one time. But for me, what's been very exciting also is just seeing the excitement of the women and the men in the community around having this focus brought to their community, being understood that they can be guardians of this forest for the whole world, and just the ennoblement and pride that they're feeling about their community mattering, that they're connected to this international network of women that is really honoring them and doing everything we can to support them. And of course, we're honoring their traditional ecologic knowledge and, you know, playing, you know, making sure that they're leading and we're standing behind them, listening to them with their leadership. And one of the unusual things that happened that was really interesting is during one of our first trainings on the ground, you know, we of course want to make sure that as we bring women together that they're protected and safe in regions that can be dangerous. And we found out that in that region, the Congolese military was interested in taking our training. All these guys wanted to take the training, and we were a little bit concerned about what would this mean for all the women. And to make a very long story short, we ended up agreeing to have them participate. And, of course, we did it in a very careful way. And it ended up that now the military in this particular region is very supportive of our project. They come to all the trainings. They're helping with the tree planting. We just did this big tree planting ceremony last month. And we have these wonderful photographs of the military guys participating in the ceremony, helping to plant trees. And, you know, it's this kind of transformative thinking that you're talking about, Caroline, and we're just really thrilled to see this happen. So we're going to be continuing to work with them for many years to come to heal the damaged lands through planting trees and also working to protect the intact forest that is there.
No, that's great, and we get to the intriguing fun distinctions. I mean, because we are creating and catalyzing the all-inclusive. We need everybody. We need right-wing golfers, inner-city kids. We need, you know, indigenous women and indigenous men. And it's true that equality would look extreme for women because it's been so whacked out. How men treat women is how humans treat the earth is how we are. So it is all intertwined. But I do love the language of astrology, which speaks of Venus and Mars within everyone. You know, and we are extending to the Venusian hero or heroine within everybody. It's what Marina Warner says, you know, where are the stories of ingenious little boys and girls making alliances with the wise foxes and resolving things through ingenuity and alliance and kinship with nature? I love that, you know, of course Scheherazade, she has to undingbat King Shahryar, who's become a sociopathic murderer of women, but she's got to save him, and then he helps save the world. So I love the, you know, you inviting the military, the Mars guys, into their Venusian being appreciated and loved into that dynamic. So because is there a difference in women's leadership, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think, you know, these are always, you know, very nuanced areas because, you know, I don't think it's about sort of setting up the dynamics that women are better than men or men are better than women. I think the point is that we need balance. We need balanced leadership. And, you know, we've been in a historical conundrum for quite some time around the, you know, these, you know, patriarchal constructs. And, you know, it sort of played itself out in terms of, as you said, you know, violence against the earth begins violence against women, and around it goes. And that we're really needing to shake this off, and that I think that when we see women entering the space of leadership, it's different and it balances the kind of leadership that we have now. So I think that that's really the point. And we're seeing, you know, very practical results. As an example, you know, there's so many studies that show that when you empower women through jobs and education, all over the world, we see the health of children improve. We see economies improve. We see populations stabilize. And all of these things are obviously really key to peacemaking, living well with the earth, sustainability. We, as I was saying earlier, around food and water production, you know, it's really key to have women in these leadership roles. So, you know, and I think there's also something else that women are bringing to the table in addition to some, you know, very practical things that have everything to do with resolving a lot of these ecological crises, is that, you know, I think it's also time that we bring our full selves to these different arenas, these formal arenas, and speak truth to power and allow women to share their emotional and spiritual intelligence, because I think everyone's really longing for that, to also realize that there's another way we need to address these things. I was just reading an article in The Guardian that was talking about how, you know, we have so much statistics around how dangerous climate change is and environmental degradations and species extinction. And, you know, every day, I mean, you could just, like, you know, cry your eyes out and grieve endlessly. And I do sometimes around, you know, just destruction that we've wrought. And that even after hearing all of this and all the stories of denial and how it's too hard to take it in, you know, there's another component, which is, you know, that we also need to hear, as you've been saying, the narration, the stories of what's going on, so that we can embrace these things in a different way. And I think this is where women are really profoundly impacting right now the political space, which is sharing, you know, exactly what's happening in their communities and what they want change. You know, so we're moving it out of just not the statistics and hammering on our heads, but also opening our heart and understanding that many other things are going on. As an example, you know, this September I had an incredible opportunity to go to the Bakken oil fields. I was invited by an incredible Indigenous woman leader, Kenny Mossett, from the Indigenous Environmental Network. And she was very generous to, through this conference, to invite a group of us to go on tour through the Bakken oil fields. And we drove through mile after mile of open flares from fracking, extreme pollution, just horrendous treatment of the land and people, and particularly the women who are subject to not only extraction of oil on their lands, but also sexual trafficking and violence due to the man camps from all these guys coming into their community to be part of extracting the gas. And so, you know, it just brought forth to my attention that, you know, listening to her stories all day and what they're doing and how, you know, she's working to have the community rise up has such a deep impact. You know, when you actually hear about the cancer rates and you actually hear about people suffering, that's the kind of thing I think we need to bring to Paris, where it's not just, you know, shuffling market mechanisms and offsets on paper back and forth through these texts, which, you know, absolutely needs to happen. It's part of the process, but also really letting us hear from frontline communities, letting us hear what they're experiencing, letting us hear what their solutions are. I think this is absolutely key at this time, and I think women are particularly poised to do it.
And again, it's the power of story, which is, you know, something wonderful happens, it becomes a story, which then travels, which inspires somebody, people to do incarnationally tangible things, which becomes a story. I mean, absolutely. I just want to play also that, you know, concerned citizens, as I am, for playful language, you know, I just like the small, the power of the small. Speak truth to power. I so prefer speak truth be power. Because then we're in a spiral. And it's actually magic. And I just think speak truth to power is still a little oppositional. As wonderful John Michael Greer says, if you want people to get nothing done but conflict, convince them they're on one side of something and you'll only get heat. What two needs is three, which is we're all in this thing together. There we go. But that's a whole other realm over there. It's like I'm so much happier with the word impact if, as David Grimes suggested, I put a hyphen in the middle and then it's impact. Because sometimes it, you know, there's impact investing and impact this and impact that, and I go, really, you want a short, violent encounter? boom. Or do you want a long, curvy, like a river, do you want a long, curvy influence? And the word influence entered our English language from astrology, it turns out. Yay. So just for the fun of it. But yes, well, points well taken, the inclusivity. But just, and again, as a little sidebar, it's like, who's more of a girl, Venusian in a way, Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton? We wonder. We go, we don't know. But yes, and then we spiral back to E.O. Wilson speaking about women when he was giving his talk at the cathedral. And he, strict Harvard science guy with a brilliant book coming out in the spring called Half Earth, in which he encourages, as a plan, really, for humans to restore half of the earth to nature, and we'll call it parks, and that way humans will be okay with it. Anyway, it's a whole, I can't wait. It's very eager. But when he was working with, evangelical Christians, and he said, we can disagree. I'm a hardcore science guy, and we can have the luxury of disagreeing in 100 years, but right now we have a unified, to restore the earth. And then he had an $8 billion plan, and he said, for $8 billion, we could probably save most species and eliminate almost all of human poverty, because the environmental hotspots are the places of greatest poverty, and again, stewardship of land and the re-guiding of the thing. And he said, and a huge chunk of that would go to women's education, because exactly as you said, birth rates go down, and all kinds of things go into that. So yes, we do that. And it's true that what you brought up, the economic incentive, we got to keep 80% in the ground of the carbon. Kim Stanley Robinson was saying there's $1.3 trillion worth of what is listed as assets in unmined carbon in the ground, and it's listed as assets by governments and corporations. And he said many well-meaning, that was kind of him to put that in there, people will have a fiduciary responsibility to burn that $1.3 trillion. And he goes, and if we do that, then, it's uninhabitable for everybody. So, yes, so again, we can, taking that on too, about the story about, we kind of got to delist the $1.3 trillion as assets, right? How do you think of playing with that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, we need to understand, first of all, that the science dictates this. This is not a negotiation. I think that's the first thing that we need to get clear about, that this isn't a business deal and we can't negotiate or buy our way out of the climate crisis. And I think that's the first place we need to begin to stand on is, science. And that scientists are telling us we need to leave 80% of all fossil fuel reserves in the ground. And that's not something, that you then begin to have a discussion about and compromise around. And I think that's some of the challenge of these quote-unquote negotiations or business deals that people are trying to make. It's as if we're talking about something that doesn't have an actual physical impact. And that's what we need to do, is change the conversation and understand that, what I'd like to see happen is, in the best of all possible worlds, which is that, these fossil fuel companies that are involved in this industry look at these facts, understand the science, and do the right thing, which is to take all those gazillions of dollars and start moving them towards clean energy sources, and realize they can still have their businesses, they can still move forward, but they need to transition from the company and the kind of energy company that they're now in to a different kind of energy company. I think, that would be like the best way that they could transition at this point. But I think there's no arguing about what has to stay in the ground, and that we have to deal with that. And I think it's extremely difficult for governments to deal with that, for corporations to deal with it. But this is why we're seeing such an uprising of people's movements to make this demand, because there's so much frustration around the sense of how slow things are going, that things are not moving at speed and scale, that, this is the hottest year on record yet this year. We are seeing hundreds of thousands of deaths due to climate change every year. Since 2010, there's been 26 million people displaced by climate change, and I'll just note that 20 million of them, 80% of those are women.
Why is that?
The greatest, basically when there's big disasters, the poor are hit first and worst, and the greatest percentage of the world's poor are women. So when you see these disasters hit, it really impacts women the most because they're the most poor, but also it's due to social norms. I mean, you know, in different parts of the world, you know, women's rights are denied, and that can have every impact on their ability to have a voice, have access to being able to even to just get some sort of transportation, be able to even learn how to swim, to have funding to do anything during a disaster or to protect themselves before one happens. And so this is really difficult, and you know why women are so impacted. Also, because women are the ones caretaking children in the home and the elderly, they're the ones who usually are not as mobile in general. So a lot of it, because of gender norms, you know, women get impacted the most.
Yes, and correct use of the word impact. Exactly, a violent encounter. That's right. And I think that, you know, the tribunal, I mean, I love you crafting the art form of the tribunal in which we replace the desire to punish with the desire to heal, ladling out our imaginative sentencing. And I love that Exxon is now in a tribunal deep investigation for fraud, because they've been lying, and grown-ups are noticing and holding accountable. So this model also of the desirable treaty, you know, it's again, we're going to want global agreements, right? I mean, it's again Kim Stanley Robinson saying, you know, government not our enemy, we are the government, let's do that. Also globalization not our enemy, we need that structure, bad rules, bad thing, but the sucking the chi out of the bad corporate greed rules and the coming up with global agreements and accountability. And you know, his plan is, you know, we're going to tax assets as well as income, and so there's no place to hide your money, but also some standards of global agreement. So in an ideal world, because why not, what would be some starter points for the desirable treaty that we all might like to see against all odds emerging from the Paris talks? And why do we call it COP21? Unfortunate language. But anyway, why is it called COP? Why are we calling it COP21?
Well, it's a committee of parties, which is basically the way that they talk about governments. It's the references to the actual governments that meet.
So it's climate.
It's the United Nations Framework Convention of Climate Change. That's the UNFCCC, United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And then this is the Committee of Parties meeting, the 21st meeting. So they've been meeting for 21 years.
Okay, it's the Community of Parties.
Committee of Parties.
And then just for the fun of it, you never know, because we question everything. I love Sarah James, great Gwich'in, who lives in the Arctic, and she says acronyms are patriarchal dominance. Acronyms are loss of intimacy. She says, please don't ever call the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge ANWR, because then we'll drill it. It doesn't take that much breath to say the full sentence. Anyway, just another thing. So the committee, because rather than call it a COP. Anyway, but I was also amazed that all these people at the faith and politics thing, you know, all representing their communities of faith, none of them had heard about the Paris talks. I'm like, I had to compost my harumphitude going, okay, compost harumphitude before speaking. But then, yes, back to you. What is the ideal?
Okay,
what would
so,
you?
Well, so let's, I'll give you some things that I'm, this is what we could all put our good thoughts into.
Yes.
We need to limit global warming to well below 1.5 degrees Celsius ceiling. We've got to do that. We really need to get that focused. And right now they're talking about 2 degrees. That's too much. And okay. Also the commitments only get us right now to 2.7 degrees. That's not good enough. We want to limit global warming to 1.5. We need to divest from fossil fuel companies and invest in clean energy and end all government fossil fuel subsidies. We need to do that. We need to put a price on carbon. We need to implement a financial transaction tax, which what that does is it funds the research and adoption of green energy technologies through development installation and to help vulnerable communities adapt to the real-time effects of climate change. That would be a really good thing. We need to recognize that transitioning to renewable energy does not justify or require a massive increase in mega hydro dams, biofuels, these monoculture biomass plantations. We definitely don't want to have any nuclear power. You know, we can do this transition in a good way. We need to prioritize natural forest protection. We really are having a problem that forests are not getting enough attention. We really need to focus on that. Again, we need to reject greenhouse gas emission reduction schemes that come from these really high-risk technologies, which, you know, we definitely don't want. It doesn't help us. I mean, that's the other thing. We're talking about this agreement in Paris. We have to remember that any agreement isn't the point. You know, we need a good agreement. Just getting an agreement doesn't work. So we don't want these reductions to come from, you know, shale gas, nuclear energy, or geoengineering. You know, we need to kind of keep the bad stuff out of here, what we call false solutions. I think we also need to address unsustainable consumption and production in the global north. I mean, I think there is a historic responsibility of the wealthier countries of the global north to the countries in the global south who are experiencing really global warming worse and first, and also understand that we have a financial responsibility to really help them in this transition and help mitigation and adaptation in the global south. But at the same time, you know, our lifestyle here needs to really be addressed. Our consumption patterns need to be addressed. I think that some of the other things is we need to protect the rights of nature, as we were talking about earlier, recognize the rights of nature in law and practice. It's time to stop treating nature as property. That's a really big thing. We have to stop the commodification and financialization of nature. I think we need to democratize our food and agriculture and feeds. We need to get, you know, rid of GMOs and really understand that agroecology, local organic farming is absolutely essential. Permaculture, and I'm so glad I get a shout out here to Penny Livingston. I love her. I'm glad she's going to be on your show. But, you know, that kind of work is really key. I think we need to protect the rights of indigenous people. We need to respect all governmental treaties with indigenous peoples and defend their right to continue to inhabit traditional lands undisturbed by industrial projects and extractive industries. I think it's so important that we honor indigenous peoples. I mean, 80% of all biodiversity on Earth right now that is left is in the hands of indigenous peoples on their territories. And I think there's a reason for that in terms of, you know, their really beautiful and powerful long-term understanding of, you know, a healthy relationship with nature. And so as we protect indigenous rights, we also protect ecosystems. And we also need to learn, obviously, from indigenous people and their sacred understanding of Mother Earth and how to live with Mother Earth. And I will just add that I really love an idea coming out of the Global South, Sumak Kalsai or Benvivir, which really talks about this deep understanding that is different from our modern view, let's say, of progress, but it's a deep understanding of living in ecological and economic balance with Mother Earth, harmony in all our relationships, personal and collective growth, appropriate to local conditions, good health and living well with community, including the community of nature, and really having that be part and particle of how we understand we need to go forward. So these are some of the things I would love to see in the best of all worlds coming out of.
We are seeing it. We are seeing it. As Gandalf said, the tide is turning. The great storm is coming. But the tide is turning. So we are seeing you taking your imp act to Paris. That's great. And the alluring invitation of Venus calling everybody to remember the goodness and again how this is a world of greater pleasure and kinship. Thank you so much, Asprey Oriel Lake, and for your goodness. And we will be traveling to Paris with you and in cahooting in perpetuity, maybe. So thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
That's great. And thanks always to Toby Schreiner in Washington, D.C., Erica Bridgman in Berkeley. I'm Caroline Casey, CoyoteNetworkNews.com. Follow me on Twitter, Stand Up Coyote, and also on Facebook, Coyote Network News. And we will reconvene next week with Penny Livingston and Permaculture Offering to World and to Paris Talks as well. Thank you, team.
This is Dennis Bernstein, host of Flashpoints.
This is Miguel Gavilan Molina, host and senior producer of Flashpoints.
Heard on KPFA every weekday from 5 to 6.
Flashpoints is a hard-hitting news magazine that monitors the centers of power and reports back to the people.
We bring community radio into the community and give voice to the voiceless, from occupied Palestine to the falsely accused on death row.
From the brown revolutions in the fields of misery to the front lines of the new labor and civil rights movement.
On Flashpoints, black and brown lives really do matter. So join us here on KPFA every weekday at 5 p.m. Thank you.
Here's another community-powered announcement from KPFA.
You are invited to enjoy Yolo County's agricultural and artistic diversity at the 8th Annual Art Farm Harvest Gala on November 6th from 6 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at the Hotel Woodland in Woodland, California. Art will include paintings, photographs, and ceramics by local and regional artists, while food, beer, and wine will be available from over 20 local farms, restaurants, wineries, and breweries. The Roy Country Band will be providing music. This is a benefit for the Yolo Arts Art and Ag Project, Yolo Land Trust, and Yolo Farm to Fork. This event will take place at Hotel Woodland at 436 Main Street in Woodland, California. This event is wheelchair accessible. For more information, please call 530-309-6464 or go to yolo, YOLO, arts.org.